Adam Curry, so nice to meet you. For those who haven't met you, you look like the young Warren Beatty, but you think like Bill Gates. There's a technologist inside this video jock, early star of MTV. I want you to guide me as to where in the world we've landed here in this blogosphere. You, me, but all of us.
Wow. I think that what we're doing right now, this interview, is a big part of where we've landed, to be quite honest. I from early on, from when I started building my first FM radio transmitter, and then had my mom drive me around the block to see how far the signal went, I've been a broadcaster. And the only reason I really became a broadcaster is because I needed something to put on the signal, so the obvious choice was a record. And then people started listening to my little station there, and then, oh, well, let me build a little mixer so I can have one record queued up to play the next one. So it was a very natural progression for me. But the airwaves were always limited. You can't just get on an FM radio station or on a television station. And that was, I think, so frustrating for me that, and I was so determined to broadcast that I was willing to do illegal stuff, even with permission from my parents.
Did you ever think of going to work for a radio station, or was that too obvious?
Yes, but where I grew up in the Netherlands, the airwaves are completely government controlled. At that time, certainly, there was only four FM signals, one being talk, one being talk music hybrid, but very easy listening. There was one pop station which came on the air at 7 and went off at midnight, and then there was the classical station. Mm. So very different environment from growing up in the States, where, although I did live here for the first few years of my life, really coming of age was in this environment where it really wasn't there. For the same reason, there was no college station to get on, or just no infrastructure whatsoever. And I've always been interested in sending out signals, not that I've ever had a message myself that I thought, ooh, this is something I have to say, but it was purely the technological part. Well, you know, here I go.
But then you passed through a brilliant career in MTV, early MTV. Mm-hmm. Then where did all this lead you? Get us from there to here.
Sure. Simultaneously, when I started at MTV, which I was kind of a part of the second wave of VJs, the video jocks, I got on the internet through one of the first ISPs in New York, Panix. And you know, very low speeds, and immediately I was like, wow, this is a network, this is a thing that you can send stuff through. And very early on I was experimenting with audio, sending it from point A to point B, which at that point was streaming audio. And that's really where I made a lot of my fundamental mistakes in my technological career, if I can speak of one that way, is I always wanted to go live from point A to point B through the internet or through any type of network. The bandwidth today still really isn't sufficient to make that work, certainly not on if you look at the cost model. Whereas with centralized broadcast such as radio, every listener, if it's commercial, every listener that you add increases your revenue without any extra cost. Whereas on the internet currently, if you're talking streaming, every listener or viewer, if you're doing a webcast that you add, increases your cost. That's a big problem. there's no way. And of course, I think everyone's looking for revenue models and for ways to make money by, if you call it broadcasting or publishing, or maybe not everyone's looking for it, but I think that would be that's a big missing factor that everyone.
What kind of social or political model were you working on, or were you thinking? I mean, I've always thought of journalism, and I came out of the print side of it, but as a sort of a piece of the democratic conversation. How did the big democratic conversation figure in what you were scheming and doing?
The feedback loop. The feedback loop of radio, where you can say something, regardless of what it is, about sports or politics or your personal life, and you can patch in a phone call and someone can say something back that the same listeners can
listen
to.
Amen. Took me a long time to get there.
Yeah, and that, I think, is why radio people with radio background, grasp weblogs so well, because there are a number of feedback loops in weblogs.
It's all feedback loop. That's, in short, why I think Dave Weiner and I hit it off philosophically from the beginning. I had done print journalism, then television journalism, both notoriously sort of one-way, talking at you but not listening kind of media. When I got into talk radio almost 10 years ago, it was a complete re-education about everything, but especially about what this country is like. Mm-hmm. People are smart. People are interesting. People are varied. People are passionate. People are incredibly articulate. They love to talk, but they also love to listen. We discovered talk radio, smart talk radio, but across a huge spectrum of subjects, as a fantastic community builder. I came to call it a coral reef of conversation,
right.
A kind of organically developing community and subject area. People would refer to conversations we've had months back on completely different subjects, but would see a parallel. That was a breakthrough for me. But then Dave Weiner had it sort of schemed out in a blogger's imagination as a kind of cosmic, mm-hmm. night and day, absolutely round the world, free, democratic exchange. And I said to Dave, all we need to do now is put the vox humana, mm-hmm. the magic of the human voice, into that bigger scheme. And we've been working on it ever since.
I totally agree. And that's where Dave Weiner and I also came together on a couple of subjects only just a few years ago. Because this feedback loop, you sit in your car, you listen to talk radio, you call in, but you may not make it on the air. You may not get past the screeners. You sit there and you talk back to your radio, say, ah, that's not true, shut up, you know, I disagree. But you can't always broadcast your opinion. So that's obvious where weblogs fill that void, particularly due to the very low cost of publishing. The minute the syndication protocols came into use, that's where it started to click in my head, because I'd always thought of the centralized model of here's where it comes from, that's where it goes out, and somehow
right.
it'll come back, but it doesn't really work that way. We have become human repeaters, what is something I call the copy-paste culture. Copy-pasting is in our blood. It's how we learn. It's how you grow up. It's literally everything about us is copying something and then replicating that. So if I read something on a weblog and I have a comment about it, then I'll copy some of it, I'll paste it, and I'll add something to it. So there is added value the minute I do that.
Yep.
And you may read it, and you may copy that and paste a bit and put your 2 cents worth, and then someone else who I don't know but who knows you will grab onto it. And so that's where these networks that where I thought it would be a centralized thing or something that's physical, or you could say, okay, these people are connected. It's not. It's I think it may be the precursor to a whole different way of communication, taking into consideration that maybe our brain waves do connect, we just don't really know it. We're just doing this on the physical layer at the moment. But somewhere in there is all of us talking, all of us filtering out, getting what we want,
yep.
adding to it, putting it back.
In a conversation that, praise God, does not have a center. This
right.
is what we've been talking about for a long time, is sort of a distributed democracy, an end-user democracy, a semiotic democracy, if you want to get fancy about it, but an open democratic conversation that does not have a ringleader. It does not have Walter Cronkite at the
Correct.
Center telling you, and that's the way it is. Thank you, Walter. We'll decide, after an almost endless conversation around the globe, back and forth many times, the way it is. I want you to tell me about your Netherlands experience today, what you're learning about media, radio, the internet, universal connections or local excitement. Mm-hmm. How does it work for you in Holland?
What's interesting about Holland, about the Netherlands, is that it's a country of a population of 17 million, with everyone almost speaks English as a second language. But Dutch is the primary language and is only useful in the Netherlands or parts of South Africa, where they still speak a version of Dutch back from the colony days, which means that the media is where we see it, I think, in the United States and other parts of the world, imploding in a way. We're seeing New York Times being called on factual errors and plagiarism, and these things are happening in an accelerated mode in the Netherlands, and it's happened to me a lot.
Really,
being on radio and on television, and my wife is extremely famous. She's a little bit older than I am, so she's been in show business for 35 years as a singer and a performer. So there's only so many celebrities you can have in a country that's smaller than Rhode Island. And the media picks up on whatever they have. And, of course, if you've ever been interviewed or someone has written something about you in a newspaper, magazine, or if it's been reported on television, it's never completely right. In fact, it's rarely ever half right.
Right.
Because it's interpretations and and a lot of hearsay and of course, a journalist.
And distillation, if only just shortening everything.
Of course. So I discovered that it was very simple with my blog to write up the story as I see it. And it is now, just by writing the truth, as I think, because there's always three or four sides to the truth, but if it's about me, I think I can be a pretty much an expert on the truth. I find myself writing something and reading that in the newspaper verbatim, copy-paste, the next day, which is partially probably because of journalists who are just lazy or would rather, you know, hey, here's what he said and copy it and put it in, but it's discrediting them at the same time.
Yes.
And giving me an incredibly powerful voice. An example of this, a new television show, a project actually that I've been involved in, started only a couple weeks ago, called Sternbörse. It's a combination of a celebrity stock exchange with 150 listed celebrities in the Netherlands, which is already quite a stretch, but a companion television show. So you're if you're familiar with the Hollywood Stock Exchange, you buy and sell shares of a celebrity, and based upon whatever pops up in the news, will make people buy that share, and it's not for real money, but it's for points, and then you can go trade in points for some, you know, whatever prizes in the gift shop. But the production company Endemol, which is huge, they produce many shows all over the world, including the States, Big Brother, Fear Factor, Millionaire shows, all kinds of reality shows, and the broadcaster Sloan Broadcasting, SBS. They formed a consortium with the leading newspaper, The Telegraph, and were convinced that they could have this three-peat of the production company with television and the newspaper, and they could kind of control the flow of information that would help people play the game and watch the television show. And I was the host of the show, still am the host of the show. Complete failure. Complete, utter failure, because viewers were not the players, and the players were not the viewers. No one was interested. If somebody wanted information about a celebrity, they would find it anywhere but in the newspaper, anywhere but in the television show. In fact, people were creating their own news on websites to boost the stock, just like a real stock market works.
So fascinating. I mean, we've got a device on the web for making established media transparent, but suddenly we're dissolving them almost entirely.
It went even a little bit further. The show, because in television, when a show is not successful out of the gate, or it doesn't live up to expectations, people start to freak out, and then they throw four more bosses on the project, and it got to a point where I said, I cannot stand this any longer. I've told individuals, this is show business, so people always say yes and do something else and talk about this guy to that guy, and it's just one big mess, 80 people. And I said, this is enough. And I said to my wife, I said, I have to post something about this enormous problematic project. And, of course, it's in Dutch, unfortunately. I should try and translate it. So I wrote about 700-800 words, and I said, look, the project is shit, and it's because these guys at Endemol are, you know, there's no captain on the ship. And I just went through the whole list of things. I thought I literally would never work again in television. Because it's a multi-billion-dollar company, and here's the host of the show publicly, which, of course, was copied by every single newspaper, every TV magazine was quoting my weblog. And I got the call Sunday night, and I thought, okay, this is it. I'm toasted. And it was the chief executive on the mall, the chief executive of Sloan Broadcasting, and the chief executive of the newspaper, all in a meeting on a Sunday night, 10 o'clock, called me. I said, Adam, if we were to follow some of the advice that you wrote on your weblog, would you be willing to write something positive about the show? And to me, I was like, that is it. You know, this dollar tool that I use to write, and I'm not an exceptionally good writer. I've gotten better since I've been writing a lot, but I'm not a good writer. But it was the honest truth coming out of my heart and my soul, and it stopped multi-billion dollar companies in their tracks and made them think about something. And not that it's going to save the show. I don't think the show is savable with what they've done, but that was an incredible milestone, I think, for what is happening. I made their entire back-end process transparent to the entire world. And there's something in there that's going to be pretty important.
You're talking about empowering not just individuals, and you're not just anybody, but we are empowering candor and expression in this new technology.
Which is basic elements of communication.
Yeah.
I think email is almost obsolete. I mean, we all know that there are huge problems. If I really need to say something that private, then email is not going to be the way that I communicate that. Probably 80% of what you have on email or the communication modus that has been used for the past 5 or 6 years all the way through every corporation. I don't think it's useful anymore. I think open conversation is extremely important, and the more stuff we hide is probably more harmful than we think. I really enjoy being very open about what I think and what I have to say and what I have to communicate, and I'm happy that other people can hear that. You have to be careful because you can hurt people. You can certainly make a lot of mistakes, but it is the basic form of communication that is just wider reach. We're not confined to our little space or the people we know. We can talk to many people. I had lunch with 5-6 people this afternoon who I feel I know almost intimately through their writing and communication back and forth throughout the blogosphere. I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Adam Curry, put your tech hat on again. Where are we heading in terms of hardware developments?
I think we're looking for different hardware interfaces. Actually, the developments I'm looking at is this program, or your programs, or your, if you want to call it blog radio, or these audio interviews. 2 years ago, when I hooked up with Dave in New York, and he had just started to really get into RSS as a syndication form, I immediately said, oh, this can solve the bandwidth problem, getting stuff from point A to point B. The problem is not transferring the stuff. The problem is waiting for it to come in. Click, wait for something to download. So if you take that away from people, if you don't know that you're waiting for something, then you don't have the perception that you waited for something. So the fact that there are enclosures now in RSS as a syndication format is totally blows my mind.
Yeah.
And the interface to the hardware is something that I have in a very small form. Is when my program that parses your RSS feed brings in a new interview on MP3, it automatically puts it onto my iPod. So that's the interface that I mean to the hardware, and I don't think about it. I pick my iPod out of the dock in the morning, hop in the car or hop in the helicopter, as it may be. I don't have the dock yet in the helicopter, but I'm working on that. And I know that there's a new interview on there, and it's ready to roll. I haven't waited for it. I didn't have to think about it. It's like, oh, I want to listen to it. I turn it on, and it's there. Imagine a radio station that you could turn on, and you get the program you want. Well, actually, we have it on television. It's called TiVo. And that's a huge success. Unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of problems with TiVo, with schedule, and who owns that. And I think that the television networks, having invested so heavily in it, will probably stifle its development somewhere down the road. But this is exactly the same thing. It is radio on demand. What I want, when I want it, and it's always there. And I don't have to wait for anything.
Listen, this is too good. It's too good to be true, perhaps. I hope not, but... let's hold it there. You've defined exactly where I hope we're all going, which is in a world of where the internet gets a voice. It's a tremendous clarification of all the nonsense, really. If you can lay the human voice on all of this conversation, but it's also time shifted. It's also global. It's also TiVo, as you said, and it's also going to be good. It's substantive, interesting. Human discourse about interesting and a lot of them important things. Let's hold it there, unless you want a last word.
Just to finalize, to say that not everyone, not everyone's voice is appropriate for voice. If we're talking pure audio, not everyone can have a conversation in audio that will work well for any type of listener, which is why writing, of course, is extremely important.
Right.
Why the web is still beautiful. It doesn't have to be multimedia, but boy, do I love hearing your interviews. Will I love watching some form of video when we get to that point, when we have people like you doing the same thing in video, which is only the tools are there. We just have to connect all the dots, which I think is a big part of what BloggerCon 2003 is about.
That's a great preview. Adam Curry, it's so much fun to meet you, and I look forward to continuing this conversation. Saturday at BloggerCon, Sunday at BloggerCon, and forever after, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the pleasure is mine, believe me.
Thank you, Adam.